Hello, I'm Brenda Tremblay, welcoming you to this special edition of Musicians of Rochester with a Galician-American composer born in Spain who now lives and works in Rochester. His name is Octavio Vázquez, and his music has been described as a burning torch for the next century by Mark Greenfest of the New Music Connoisseur. Octavio started writing at the age of 7 in a time and place when art and culture was basically viewed with some suspicion. You'll hear about his journey to a life rich in music against the odds, a funny story about how he became a music director of a church at the age of 12, and of course we'll hear lots of his music. Dr. Vázquez now teaches at Nazareth College, where he directs the composition program. He was born and raised in a city in Galicia, Spain.
I was born during the last few years of the dictatorship. We mentioned this before, you know, when music was not particularly well regarded. There was very, very little going on. There were no orchestras at all in Galicia. There was, I think, in the whole country, there was one non-professional string quartet of dubious ability, although I never met them. And that was it. And then there were a few wind ensembles locally. But, you know, for my parents, musician, I mean, the words, you know, delinquent, criminal, musician, they were all synonyms, you know. Like
music was threatening to the regime?
Any form of culture was downplayed.
So how did you get pulled into a world of music and composing if you grew up in a country where music was considered sketchy?
That's a very good question. Well, I since a very early age, I started, sounds a little spooky, no, but started hearing music in my head that I hadn't heard elsewhere, and I wanted to write it down for some reason. I was very, yeah, I don't know, 5 or 6 years old. So by 7, my brother got us a present, a little, it's called a Casio tone. It's like a little keyboard with like calculator machine keys, but they also play notes one at a time. And that was the first thing resembling a musical instrument in my household. So he played with it one day, and then he never saw it again.
You were how old?
I was 7. And so I started fooling around with the little thing, and the writing things down, I don't know why I have this urge to write it down, because at that age I didn't play so much that I couldn't remember everything by heart easily. But it was a calculator machine, so it had numbers and signs, and so I could write down with numbers and signs, like my scores of the time, like 1, 3, 3, 2, plus, equal, you know, and then I could record the pitch that way. And of course, then the length of each note was not included. So I realized that after a while, and I started adding little dots and commas above and underneath, look like Hebrew, but with numbers.
So you were inventing your own notation system.
For a couple of years until I discovered, regular notation.
That's amazing. Absolutely amazing. How did you discover regular notation?
I think that was mostly the result of torturing my poor mother, who was trying to, you know, doing things around the house, and I could follow her around. Every time I discovered something that I thought was revolutionary on my little cast, I could follow her around. I insist that she listen to it. And then walking down the street one day, she saw they opened a music store. It was the first music store in my town ever. Now, the guy who opened it couldn't really make a living very well. The business wasn't going so well. So he started offering lessons after hours. And one of these lessons were organ lessons. He had Hammond electronic organs that you could have five-finger room plugged with headphones and have five kids practicing without bothering each other. So my mother said, oh, perfect, I will sign him up for lessons, and I don't have to, you know, deal with that anymore. He can do it. So I started going to lessons. That was once a week, 1 hour a week, and then I couldn't practice anywhere, but they thought that was okay. You just go to your lesson 1 hour, and that should be enough. So that was the first time I really had a score in front of me. The score was very simple. It was just the right-hand melody, and then there were chords, like jazz notation chords written on the other part. And my new music teacher, the first lesson, put the score in front of me and said, she said, "You know how to read this, right?" And I didn't say anything. I just looked at it, and the melody was ta 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 ta. And she played it for me, and so when it went up in the score, it went up on the keyboard, and down, down, it was very, you know, obvious somehow. And so I said yes, and I played it, and somehow I picked it up on the go.
Wow, that's incredible. So she didn't know that you couldn't read music.
No, I lied.
Everyone else is going, "Every good boy deserves fudge," or whatever it is they teach little kids.
Well, she gave me the first note, and then I remember the melody.
Wow, that's fantastic.
She suspected something, because the melody had been simplified to make it easier to play, but I just remember the melody from hearing it before, so I played the actual melody how it was. And then she was a little bit dismayed, like, "No, no, that's not what's written there." But I think she let me get away with it. You know, I said, "But that's not the real melody," and she was fine.
So you must have just caught fire, you know, learning keyboard, reading notation, discovering this language that you could express what was in your imagination.
I was in heaven. I was in heaven for a year and a half, after which, even with the lessons, the owner of the store couldn't keep in business. So he closed and he moved to a bigger town. And then for about a year, I had absolutely nothing to play. I was back to my little calculator keyboard, and that was it. Fortunately, at the same time, we had the opportunity to play recorder in school. So I was playing recorder a lot. And then a little miracle happened, which is my family and I, we went on vacation pretty far to the south of Spain. We never went on vacation that far. We would go to my grandparents' house in the countryside. That was it. So we went, and all the way there is a little British property. It's called Gibraltar. So in Gibraltar, sales taxes were either non-existent or very low. So we went there, and somehow I convinced my parents, or I guess I had been nagging them for a while, to buy me a little keyboard. It was an electronic keyboard. It was really tiny. You know, it was 4 octaves, and the keys were not real size. It was half size, but they could play 8 notes at a time. This, for me, was, you know, a revolutionary step for me. It's like Neil Armstrong said when he stepped on the moon, small step for me, but a big step for mankind. It was the opposite. It was a small step for mankind, but it was a huge step for me. So they bought me this little keyboard, and I continued my training on my own, kind of thing. I kind of taught myself for another year until I felt that I could play what I wanted to. And then I discovered the local church. There was an organ, pretty big. I mean, it was electronic, but it was large, like the one I used to play in the store, even larger. And nobody played it, ever. There was no music. So I thought, I had to do something about this. So I went to a service, and I waited until the end. I had brought my keyboard hidden. I waited until everybody left, and then I sat in another corner. I turned it on, and I started playing to the best of my ability at the time, whatever I thought was more impressive. And it worked. The pastor came by. There were two priests there, the main one and the assistant or something. And the main one looked at me and said, "Oh, you play organ?" I said, "Yeah, sure." "So could you play the one over there?" And I said, "Poof, of course, what a question." Meanwhile, the other one was staying behind, the associate priest was behind the main one saying, like, "Don't let him. It's a very expensive thing. He may break. Don't let him touch it."
Anyway, how old were you, 9, 10?
I was 12. I was 12 already.
Okay, wow.
So he did let me touch it. You know, I played. They liked it. And as a result of that, I became the organist, which meant there was no money involved at all. But I had a key of the church.
You had access.
A very long key. It was a huge, it was a 13th century church. With many reconstructions since then, but it's a fantastic building with a huge key. I still have a copy.
What was the name of the church?
St. Peter. St. Peter Church. It used to be, before being a church, was a Franciscan monastery, or part of a Franciscan monastery. And now it's like a parish church in the center of Lugo, in a medieval town where I was growing up at the time. The town is about 90,000 people. That's the extent of it.
Oh.
So back then, it was still right after. We were no longer in a dictatorship, but it had just been recently, you know, we had a very new democracy, which meant, I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but it was a very funny regime in which it was Nazi and fascist in ideas, but also Catholic. It was called National Catholicism. So you kind of had to go to church religiously, which meant there were masses all day long, into the evening, every single day. It's no longer the case, but at the time it was. So basically, I play one mass a week as an organist, but there was never any time to rehearse, because there were always people to practice, for me to practice. There were always masses going on, and they only had a short lunch break, and they had a cleaning lady at the time, and I didn't feel, you know, I was very shy to, you know, practice with the cleaning lady. So, long story short, I had to go after dinner. So I would arrive at 11 p.m. and stay until 1 or 2 in the morning, along in a 13th century church. No heating, huge building. It was very interesting.
Your parents okay with that?
Well, see, if I was going anywhere else, they probably wouldn't have let me. But since I was going to be locked inside a church by myself, they thought it was reasonable enough. And
was it spooky?
Actually, you know, I'm not easily spookable. I don't get spooked out. But I have to say there were all sorts of very strange noises that I fully investigated. I was not afraid. I would go downstairs, looked around, could never figure out where they came from. There were very strange things going on in the church. But if anyone would be interested in that kind of phenomena, I would definitely recommend that they spend the night there. And I'm sure they have something interesting to report in the morning.
Especially such an old building. That's amazing. So you're practicing late at night. Were you teaching yourself more? Were you getting more advanced, challenging yourself with new music? Were you writing music? All of it?
All of it, basically. I was even teaching. I was teaching. I had a little choir, and I was teaching them solfege and how to read. And, you know, when I was 13, I think I was 13, there was in the school where I was attending, that was, by the way, another Franciscan monastery. I went to school in a Franciscan monastery. There was an after-hours music program where, I mean, I didn't really learn to read there. I already knew how to, but we had an ensemble, very strange ensemble. We had a number of recorders and a clarinet or two, perhaps a saxophone. Later, a trumpet was added. That was a kind of ensemble. So I would play it in the ensemble, and I wrote some pieces for them or arranged some pieces for them. And at some point, the teacher who taught that class said, well, you have to bring me this money, and I'm going to register you in the conservatory. I had never heard the word conservatory before. It sounded to me like a place where you have a lot of preserves or something, like cans of food, or what is a conservatory? So I went and gave him the money, and he did the rest. And then he said, you have to appear this day at this hour. And so I did, and it was a room full of people. And those were exams of solfege and music theory and these things for people who were not officially registered to take lessons there. They would just go and take the exams, and if they pass, they go on to take the next one, which would have been great, only that I didn't know what I was there to do. So suddenly I was in this room full of kids, and they were all taking the exam, and I understood very quickly what was happening. Fortunately, I had the book they were examining them from with me, and fortunately my name started with a V, and they were alphabetical, so I had some time to prepare while everybody else was going in front of me. But that was my first experience with a conservatory. That's how I understood these places existed. I did well. So then the next year, I actually prepared, because now I knew what was happening. And by the time I left Lugo, I had, it's a very different system in Spain for music studies, but I had what is called elementary degree, which is equivalent, well, it's 5 years of solfege and music theory and 4 years of instrument, in my case, piano.
Fantastic. So who along the way realized that you had some kind of special gift?
Well, there were three people mainly. There was, even though he was not a musician, but he was the first person who actually listened to me seriously and took me seriously, was the headmaster of the school, who was a Franciscan monk, a very, very interesting person. I'm still in touch with him. He's a very fantastic individual. So he definitely took me seriously, and even though we didn't talk much about music or about anything, I mean, I was a student and he was a headmaster, you know, not oftentimes we talked, but it was always a very important presence for me to have around. And then the music teacher that taught the after-hour class, he realized something, and what he did that was really important for me is he introduced me to the only professional musician in the whole city, which was the director of the municipal wind ensemble. Every member of the wind ensemble was a volunteer, and he was the only actual salary for making music. And again, by a little miracle, he is a wonderful, wonderful musician. He had studied in Switzerland, in France, and the only reason he was there is because he was Galician and he wanted to be back home. But he was very, very high, wonderful musician, conductor, composer.
Sophisticated. Knew the world.
Yes, completely different. So he saw me. He looked at what I had been writing, with absolutely no guidance. And he said, okay, so why don't you come Monday? So I went Monday, and then he taught me for a whole year. For free, my parents didn't even know anything. He taught me composition for a year. I wrote a few pieces for him. That actually, the first pieces in my catalog are the ones that I wrote with him. And that was my last year in Lugo. I was 17. And then it was time for me to go to college. And you know, that's.
And you went to Madrid?
I went to Madrid. That was also a very funny story. You know, because I mentioned, right, for my parents, musician, delinquent, criminal, they were synonyms. So they didn't take it kindly that I would want to do this. They got very worried, and they insisted that I do something, you know, reasonable and respectable. So I didn't go to Madrid to study music. I should say I was taken to Madrid. I didn't go on my own accord to study architecture. It's a long story how architecture and not something else, but point is, I you know, it wasn't, we were on the same page, my parents and I.
What did your parents do for a living, if I can ask?
Sure. They all had very colorful lives. My dad at the time was an officer of the army, and my mother was a doctor, which is a more modest occupation in Spain than it may sound like in the U.S. Both very colorful. My grandparents, none of them could go to college of any sort. I mean, they all lived through the war or they were in exile. My great-grandfather was actually lived in New York for a long time, left when he was 14 or 15, and had a very colorful life. They all have very colorful lives, but not many means and not many. My parents was the first generation that actually made it to college. So they overdid it. Like, my father has 3 degrees and my mother has 2. But you know, my mother fortunately found medicine. She likes that. My father was never quite satisfied with any of the things he did study. But yes, they were afraid of this music
because
business.
Of the political climate. In part,
the political climate. They had no references, no living. I mean, they heard of foreigners, you know, in Germany and things. But this is like the moon or Mars. You know, this is something you hear about from a remote distance, but there were no references in their environment or in their life experience. So when I went to Madrid, they sent me to study something. I did something else. It was a big disaster. We didn't talk for almost a year with my father. I didn't talk for almost a year.
Wow.
Rather, he wouldn't talk to me.
Because you signed up for music and he thought you were studying architecture.
Well, I told him many times that I was not going to, but he insisted, and then you know, it came to a it came to a moment of great drama when he wouldn't let me leave Madrid until I took my architecture exams, and I didn't show up for the exams. And yes, that was not very pretty.
You're on speaking. Did you reconcile with him eventually?
Yes, yes. No, it was wonderful. Yeah, it took a couple more years. Mm-hmm. I was at the conservatory then. They finally gave in, and I was able to be at the conservatory in Madrid. And after 2 years, that was my third year in Madrid, they came to a concert. It was at the end of the year, there is a concert. And so they came to the concert. And that was a particularly good year for me. I was closing the concert. I was performing my own music, and I had gotten all these special prizes and things. And that was nice, of course. But for my parents, I think the big discovery was to meet my professors. And contrary to popular belief, they were normal-looking people in suits, very normal and respectable, and you know they didn't have tattoos and earrings, and they were not addict to any drugs, addicted to. So they were very impressed by the fact that they looked perfectly reasonable and members of society. So that was a big turning point. And they seemed to like me, too. I was doing well. So they thought, well, he can finish here. Maybe he can get a job working with these people. That's fine. That's good enough for us. So that was a big turning point.
Writing music, you were finishing it in Madrid. What got you to the Peabody Conservatory?
That was another little miracle. My life is full of them. So what happened is they had just opened or perhaps upgraded. There was this one music library in Madrid that had just been, apparently had existed before, I've been told recently, but they had like things from the 16th century that nobody had studied, that kind of thing. But it was upgraded. They got a Grove Dictionary of Music. They got complete works of Mozart and Beethoven. And I discovered the place. I was there constantly. And they got this one book. It's called The Shermer's Guide to Music Schools Throughout the World. Now, Shermer is an American publisher, which means our listeners cannot, I can show you. This was the U.S. and this was the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. Let's say like 80% of the book was about the U.S.
A little biased.
Slightly, but but it worked well for me. So I looked through the book, and just to give you an idea, I had never even heard the name of Juilliard, let alone anything else. So I looked through the description of the departments and schools, and I wrote down the ones that I thought were more interesting, and I came up with a list of 23. And the book said, if you're interested, you should send a letter. So I sent the letter. And they started receiving catalogs, which, you know, is very normal here. But back then in Spain at the time, the kind of book that a catalog is would be very, very pricey. And suddenly, all these books were coming from the U.S. to my parents' house. They were very worried, like, what have you done? You know, they thought we're going to have a huge bill to pay or something. And no, they were for free. It was like very strange. So looking at the catalogs, the little instructions said you should apply at least to three in case. So I came down to Peabody, New England, and Juilliard. Considering I didn't know anything about the country, I think I did pretty well with the selection. and then came time to apply. And the application fee was about $100. $100, this is pre-euro. We had pesetas back then. $100 was my entire salary of a whole month. There was absolutely no way I could apply to three. It was already hard to apply to one. So I decided to apply to one only. It was a very hard decision. But I eventually Peabody, of the three, was the only one that included self-deprecating jokes in the materials. So I thought, these people are funny. They have a sense of humor. Let's go there. And so I applied. I got in. They gave me some scholarship. I was very happy when I talked to my parents. You know, I got in this amazing place. They gave me some money. And they said, oh, okay, that sounds good. So how much is tuition? I told them. I had a big laugh because between the two of them, they didn't make even the amount of a year tuition So it's like, it's great, but, you know, nothing's going to happen.
Good luck with that.
And then there were only two, how would you call them, scholarships that were available in Spain that could cover such a thing from private banks. So I applied to both. And the first one, I got it, and then I didn't have to go to the interview. The second one, so that was fantastic. It's not so well known here. It's called Barea Scholarship, but it's very similar to the Rhodes Scholarship, if you've heard of it. They really take care of you completely. Not only I didn't have any expense, I saved money.
That's fantastic.
There is a fantastic organization.
Now, all along, how clear of an idea did you have about what you wanted to do? You know, keyboard, composition. How much did you see a vision of yourself, you know, moving forward?
I knew I was going to write music. That was it. I was very clear. Not everybody was so clear. But yeah, no, I was very clear the composition was the one thing I wanted to do. And in fact, my degree is from Madrid, from the conservatory, not in composition, but mostly because I didn't find a professor that I could relate to. And the ones, I tried several, and it was never a good match. So I took degrees in piano, and I did studies in conducting and musicology, anything really but composition. Composition, I kept going from professor to professor, but it didn't lead anywhere.
But that's what you wanted to do.
Exactly. And that's what I went to do at Peabody, and then later at Maryland.
Now, you said when you were, you know, a child, you would hear music in your head. Has that been a steady thing in your life? Do you sort of have, you know?
Yeah, well, so when I sit to write or you know, music comes quite effortlessly, I would say, and that's never been a problem. But sometimes I hear it with such clarity that really it does not feel that I'm quote-unquote composing. It's like you hear something on the radio and say, okay, I heard it on the radio, you know, you can write it down, and only you didn't hear it on the radio, you just heard it. So that's a little bit disconcerting. I mean, I'm always very excited. It doesn't happen that often that I hear it with such clarity. But it's always very exciting and disconcerting too, because sometimes I really couldn't tell you whether I wrote it. I have this very early piece that I heard when I was very young, and I can play it, and it's like a little march in classical style. Sounds very like should be playing a harpsichord or something. I, you know, for years I looked for it because I was sure someone must have written this. I must have heard it somewhere, and I haven't found it, but that doesn't mean anything. I mean, I really couldn't tell you. And another thing that happens sometimes is that I dream music. And when this happens, invariably, it's music that I remember as well as I can. I'm not so good at remembering dreams, but it's unbelievable. Doesn't sound like anything I've heard before. I just have a very hard time writing it down. If I go to a concert and I listen to any piece of music, it's not tremendously hard for me to figure out, you know, how to write it.
Isn't that what happened to, was it Tortelli that dreamed about the devil
playing the
violin?
Oh, the devil trill, yes.
And he woke up and he couldn't get it down, but, you know, he tried as much as he could.
That's a perfect story. So I try as much as I could. I come up with something, people tell me, oh, that's fantastic. And then I'm thinking, if you only could hear my dream, it falls short, but I try.
I listened to some of the triptych that you wrote, the little piece for the piece for bassoon and oboe and piano, and I loved it. And I heard it was absolutely original, but then I also heard kind of a thread of Stravinsky through it. I know a little bit of Poulenc, a little Debussy. You know, what were you listening to? Who are your biggest influences?
I get this question pretty often, and my answer sounds a little bit strange, but it's true. My biggest influences truly were Mozart, Beethoven, and Bach. And you said, well, that's very far remote, like something closer. And I can definitely mention, 20th century composers that I like very much. But really, those three, especially Mozart, I remember before I even knew who, well, I kind of knew who Mozart, I had heard the name, but knew much of his music. I remember turning on the radio, there was a classical radio station. I didn't listen to it that much because the reception was never great. And if there was distortion, I really hated it. But if the signal was strong, it was heaven, that thing. So I put it on, and they were playing Mozart's Requiem. I didn't know what it was, but I fell off my chair. It's very funny because I tell my students and they look at me funny. It's like, you like that stuff? It's like very old. For me, it's not very old. I relate to the, 18th century easily. So I ran for a tape. We had tapes back then, to a blank tape to record a little bit of it. And I just got the little snippet. I was very impressed. After that, all the normal names that everybody knows, Chopin, Brahms, Schubert, Schumann, Mendelssohn, everybody in the 19th century, Mahler, perhaps particularly towards the end of the 19th century, and then in the 20th century, of course, everyone you've mentioned, Shostakovich I would mention in particular. I'm very fond of, I feel very close to his music. I feel very close to many people's music, but Shostakovich in particular has, to me, a spiritual component that I find to be rare.
Well, he lived in a politically dangerous time, too.
Yes. There might be some other kinship besides that.
Maybe, yeah. How did you get into film composing?
Well, I always collaborated with different people, different projects since I was in the conservatory. I didn't think of myself as a film composer, but then while I was still in Madrid before I came here, there was a revival of silent films in Madrid. It was like a new thing. And originally they had me play with a live pianist or something. And nobody knew me. I was a student at the conservatory. But they called someone, and nobody wanted to do it, basically. They kept recommending other people to do, because to sit and improvise for an hour or two, most classical pianists don't train for that. I was happy improvising. I was completely self-taught, and I improvised 4 hours. And then, so I took the job. I did live a few times, and then I was hired by a company to do it for 33 movies on a studio. I recorded the improvised piano soundtrack for 33 silent films from the 20s and 30s. Right before I came to the U.S.
That's fantastic. A little daunting.
A little daunting, yes. And also because it's very little time. It's not like you could do it over and over. I did everything in 3 weeks, so like 10 movies per week. Yeah, like
wow.
2 per day approximately. And then in the U.S., I didn't think about it for a while. And then in 2006, I think it was, there were a couple of I thought they were very good movies, like Blood Diamond or The Constant Gardener, or things that I thought were very powerful. They had a social message too. It was like this combination of the best of film, but also with some social concern or something. And I had the idea like it could be great to be part of something like this. So I started getting more interested, and since then, I've done collaborations with different filmmakers. Many of them were students, graduate students at the time, and now they're professionals, and nobody knows what's going to happen. Most filmmakers don't get to, make big feature films, but, the possibility is always there. So I've done a number of collaborations. I've written a number of movies, film scores. Nothing that you could have heard of in major theaters at the time. But
well, you're making a living. Your parents must be relieved that somehow, you're actually...
Yes. Know? No, another turning point, and backing up, but when I got that scholarship I told you about, it's a very prestigious scholarship. That was their highest point of happiness, I think, because they thought, well, with this scholarship, nothing can go possibly wrong. He'll be there for 2 years. He'll come back. Everybody will know him, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And the only problem for them is that I didn't come back. But I didn't go back. But after that, you know, I have a pretty strong career as a composer in Galicia, where I come from, and also in the U.S. After I finished my studies, I freelanced as a composer in New York for 15 years before I came to teach in Nazareth.
Who are your clients? Who are you writing for?
All sorts of symphony orchestras, chamber ensembles, soloists, institutions very often. Like there would be an anniversary or something, or some big institutional celebration. And it's oftentimes governmental or private foundations or institutions that commission for an ensemble to play it, but for a particular occasion.
I saw that Galicia Symphony is playing a piece that you wrote called Eleusis?
Yes. Well, that was originally a commission of the Radio and Television Orchestra of Spain, and that was in 2013, I believe. The piece, it makes reference to the Eleusinian mysteries. There were ancient world mysteries during the Greek and Roman Empire times. They were very, very popular. People would go there from all over the known world. Several Roman emperors made the pilgrimage to Eleusis to go through the ritual, and apparently it had wonderful effects, and you know, people reported increased happiness with life and no fear of death and after the experience. It is now believed by most scholars that it included some kind of substance that would give you
an out-of-body experience.
An out-of-body, yes. An out-of-body experience, something like that, yes.
Like as in the Elysian Fields. Yes. That's what that comes from, right?
Yes, that's a part of life in the afterworld. That's, I guess, equivalent to paradise. Mm-hmm. The Greek underworld was very full of things, very detailed, like all these different places where you could go, and it's almost like a map, like a carefully drafted map of everything that can happen. So yes, if you lead a wonderful, how shall we say, good enough life, then you got to go to the Elysian Fields, and you didn't not have to reincarnate anymore. Otherwise, you kept reincarnating until you got it right.
So how do you capture that in a piece of music?
Well, that particular piece of music has a little bit of the tone-poem quality of there are common themes to initiations, initiatic ceremonies throughout history, even nowadays. There are many mysterious schools that are still operating, like Freemasonry being one that is well-known, but there are many others. And they all have, they share common elements. So I kind of took from here and there what I thought were the most powerful symbols, if you want, and put together a little, I should say there is nothing on the score. There is nothing written on the score, like in here comes a cave and play like a cave. But there is a cave, actually. There is this feeling of starting somewhere underground and going through different initiations and different ritual parts of the initiation, and eventually coming out from under the earth as if it was a rebirth, you know, being born out of the earth again after having had all these experiences and being transforming away. They say, there's a Zen master who said, you know, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. So nothing really changes. You still have to go to work and do your things. It's all the same as you left it. But you don't look at it the same way. It is your own perception of things that is shifted.
Has it been recorded, commercially recorded yet?
Not commercially recorded. It's been recorded twice, once by the Spanish television, and it was broadcast by the Spanish National Network when it was originally premiered. And now it has been recorded the second time around by the Galician Radio, very good quality recording. But of course, it's a live performance, it's not commercial.
Mm-hmm. And you're going to Winnipeg next month for a conference with Philip Glass?
Yes, it's the Winnipeg New Music Festival. It's a wonderful, wonderful music festival. Of course, I hear Winnipeg is rather chilly in January.
Oh, it's not warm like here in Rochester.
No, like
really, really
like
cold.
Like really, really cold.
Okay.
I think probably that's part of their motivation to hold a music festival then, because otherwise, why would you go to Winnipeg in January, February? But I'm very excited about this. It's a wonderful festival. Philip Glass is the main composer this time around. He will be there for the whole week. He will perform some of his music. There will be a premiere of his latest string quartet. The 11th symphony that he wrote this year will be played as well. And in addition to him, works by other composers. There is a premiere by the Harry Staphylakis, is the Winnipeg Symphony Orchestra composer in residence. There is a composer institute for young Canadian composers. So I believe it's 7 of them will come, will have their pieces read or played. And I'm part of the Composers Institute. I'm one of the guest composers that will be, giving master classes, speaking on panels, and hopefully mentoring in the best way I can these young, upcoming Canadian composers.
How do you do a master class for composers? I understand how it works for a singer or a pianist. Do you listen together and then lead a discussion? Do you actually look at their music on paper? And
that's a very good question. Oftentimes I look at the music on paper, and if there is a recording, sure, we can listen. If there is no recording, sometimes composer will come with a finale or Sibelius file. I keep cautioning them, about thinking whatever the computer sounds like is really resembling
what
it's going to sound like with a real orchestra. I mean, for some things, it's definitely useful, and it's a very quick way to see if there is anything, like wrong notes, for instance, like accidentals missing, something like that. For balances and colors, there is so much the prom can do. But music is a funny thing. Composition is such a essential, private in a way, or personal thing to do. And so you're right, how can you give a master class in that? Well, I guess in a way what I do is I do my best to connect to whatever they bring and see if within that connection I can interact with them, I can interact with the piece, and I can actually give them ideas or things to listen for. And I find that it works. I find that we hear similar things, and I can somehow get a little bit inside their minds or their inner beings, and there is some possibility of connection. This is, of course, if I'm working with one composer on one particular piece. If I'm talking to a number of them about the general topic, then I usually talk about the creative process as it relates to myself. But that tends to give for a very lively discussion, usually.
It's about your working methods and how you get your ideas on paper?
Yes. More than methods, the really inner workings of where does it all come from? How come? What are we all doing in the room? Shouldn't we be studying, law or medicine? These questions that, on one hand, they're obvious, but on the other hand, like, why? Why you're all, I tell them, you're all a number of smart young people. What are you doing here? Run for your lives. There's no future in this business, right? So this is, being a composer, it's a little bit like falling in love. You fall in love with this person because, it's in the bank account and he has a good job and, or no, it's just like, yeah, I understand. That's that would be a good prospect, but I actually like the other one. And why is that? Nobody knows. So I think it's important they realize that it is completely rational. It's the most irrational choice you can do is go into classical music or composition as a career choice. And because it's irrational, best things in life are irrational. Why do you marry this person and not the other one? It's irrational. It must be. If you try to make it rational, then you're in the wrong field.
So you talk about passion and
connection to the inner, to their inner core. It connects to spirituality and to what is life and what is not, and what are we doing here? It's for me, it's a very essential part of being, you know. And so, if it's essential for them, which turns out is usually the case, then you know, all sorts of things come out, and we talk about them. If it's not, I think it's a good moment to consider other options.
Well, why is music so essential to you?
I couldn't tell you. It is the way it is. It's like, why, you know, why do plants grow up instead of going the other way? I don't know. It's just how it works. I guess for me, it's the most direct and powerful way of being what I am. It's of just... It just happens like that. When I was very young, I thought about all the things, like, what would happen if for some reason I couldn't do this? Of course, it was hypothetical questions that are never true, but if for any reason I couldn't do this, so to give myself a sense of myself, of what could come second or third, you know, because I have to say, I really love science. I'm big math and physics, how would you call it, dilettante, you know, like, I really like these things. And I really consider subatomic physics for a while because I find it fascinating and all the possibilities and the essential fabric of the universe. But I came to the conclusion that composition was number one. If it wasn't composition, it could be painting. I painted for a while, but, you know, never too seriously. But, and if it wasn't painting, it would be writing. And only that, if I couldn't do anything in those lines, then I would go into science. So for some reason, for me, this artistic expression, if you want to call it that way, it's a more direct, more immediate, more powerful way of developing faster a relationship to myself, to truth, to the universe, to life.
They're all forms of self-expression.
Yes, but not the small self. You know, this for me it became very clear very quickly. It's not about Octavio. When I'm writing well, Octavio is not there. If Octavio is there, the only thing he does is get in the way. It's expression of something, but it's not, you know, Octavio Vazquez, who was born in somewhere and went somewhere. It's not it. It's all of us and everything put together or nothing.
So you're tapping into something that's bigger than yourself?
I hope so. Because otherwise, my music would be very limited. Octavio Vazquez is a very limited individual. So if I was to control, if I was to invent my music, I don't think I could go very far with that. In other words, I don't invent it. I don't make anything up. I write down what I hear. And what I hear, when I encounter music, I encounter it as a living, I don't know, how shall we call it, a living somethingness, a living entity, which if I can serve as a vessel for it to come into here, into this world, fantastic. It's the joys of motherhood in a way, and it includes some labor, and sometimes, you know, it's a lot of work and painful and whatever, but you know, we have children. Well, I haven't that I know of, but... you know, people have children, and then, you know, they turn five and they tell you something. I say, but I didn't teach you that. Who told you this? Like, he has or she has the wrong ideas. It's amazing. They're alive. They're not something we put together, we invented, we control. It's the opposite. They're alive, and they surprise us in amazing ways. And with music, I find it the same. My pieces surprise me all the time. They teach me things that I don't know, constantly.
Do you ever come up to a roadblock? Do you ever get to a point in a composition that you just don't know where to go next?
It has happened, yes. I can tell you two things. One is a normal, it's not really a roadblock much, but when I was writing my first orchestral piece in my catalog, you know, I wrote and wrote and wrote, and then I came to this place where I didn't know what was happening next, and I just didn't hear anything. So I just kept going to the same spot, like playing through until I got there and listening and see what comes next. And that took quite some time. I ended up looking at the score so long that by the time I was done, the score was looking at me with more intensity than I could. I was too tired, like the notes were moving by themselves. But eventually I heard what came afterwards, and I kept going. I always had the feeling with pieces, with many classical pieces, but classical, I didn't mean exactly classical, romantic, whatever, like I'm thinking about Beethoven now. There is this moment in C minor sonata, the famous one, I can't think of the name now, the pathetic, when the second theme appears and it's in E flat minor instead of E flat major, and sounds so perfect, and yet, how do you think of it? And for me, it's that same feeling of something that is, on one hand, surprising, but on the other hand, so necessary there where it goes. That's the same feeling I had with that piece that I was working on. It wouldn't come until it came, and when it came, it was surprising for me. And I think it might be surprising for anyone that listens to it for the first time, but then it's exactly what goes there. Like, I couldn't think of it any other way. So in that way, yes, there are times where, you know, a particular section or something takes a little bit longer to come, but eventually it comes. A more serious block, I couldn't call it block, but I once was commissioned to write the piece for a very big anniversary, for the pilgrimage to Santiago. And this is more than 800 years old, officially, and unofficially over 1,000 years old. So I figured, I was very happy with the commission, immediately accepted, and I thought, well, something where so many people have gone and lived through and suffered and died and whatever, for sure there is all this, you know, all this, I don't know how to call it, like spiritual energy, if you want, that as soon as I start thinking about it, ideas are going to come, rushing. Well, I started thinking about it, nothing was coming.
Huh.
And I had plenty of time for this. Sometimes they give you very short deadlines, but this one I had plenty of time. So I said, well, okay. So I bought books on the subject. I read about it. I did, this is what I call my research. I did, you know, read about it, listen to things, look at pain, nothing. And then time was passing by and still had nothing. And then I said, I took a word, like, you know, this is a big piece. I had to write it, and I'm running out of time. So in desperation, I took a 12th century melody that pilgrims used to sing back then, and I took the melody. This is a beautiful, gorgeous melody. I did this very fancy orchestration. It says, like, if I cannot come with any original music, at least I'm going to take this old melody and I'm going to just have the most creative orchestration I can come up with. So for 2 weeks, I worked on it very intently. And I finished the section. I was pretty happy with it at the time. And then I went to sleep, and I woke up one morning with a fresh head, and I listened to it and said, oh my God, what have I done? This sounds like The Lord of the Rings. Well, it didn't exactly.
It's not a good thing.
It wasn't exactly The Lord of the Rings, but I thought, this is strange. This is so I was very dismayed, and immediately started writing something else, more in line with things I had written in the past, like when, you know, the panic button is like, fall back to something you know how to really well and do another version of that, different enough, but similar. So I started doing that. Anyway, eventually, after doing the second part for a while, I listened to the first part and said, well, it's not that bad after all. And then I thought, are they going to even get together, these two? They are so different. They weren't so different. It worked all very well. I was very happy with the final result. And this being stuck in a way that made me focus on orchestration rather than anything else, very particularly on orchestration for a while, because I did nothing else for 2 weeks, it opened doors into new possibilities that I, you know, I wouldn't have perhaps otherwise think of and thought of, and it has affected my orchestration since, like the results of that block or whatever it is, they really, I think, have enhanced my orchestral writing scenes. There are all these new possibilities and discoveries that I probably wouldn't have, at least not so quickly, gone into. So who knows?
Do you think you thrive if you have a shorter time to write?
Well, I don't know if I thrive, but definitely write faster.
Now, you said that you like when you're writing well. You feel like you're writing not as a small version of yourself, but, you know, you're tapping into something deeper. How does it feel when things are going well? What does that feel like?
On one hand, it feels fantastic. On the other hand, I'm not really there to feel it. You know, it's like sometimes athletes describe this state of flow where they've been running for a while and then, you know, you no longer, you just keep putting one foot after the next.
You lose track of time.
You lose track of everything. Mm. It becomes a little bit impossible that you're able to keep running after whatever number of miles. That something disappears of your normal consciousness, and that gives way for some other state. There is fantastic. There is something fantastic about it. Maybe there is something fantastic about having your thinking mind engage, so fully engaged in something that it doesn't bother you with anything else. No worries, no nothing, no who you are, I don't know, I don't remember. No past, no present, no future, just that moment, just that present moment. That mind or part of the mind is fully engaged. So everything else is free to just flow, to be, and it's a fantastic experience. I wouldn't call it pleasurable necessarily. It's just, it's a little transcendent, perhaps. That's a better word.
I understand. Yeah, for sure. What are you working on now that you're excited about?
Well, I'm very excited. The semester is almost over.
Yeah, well, how come you, what made you want to teach after all those years of freelancing? Was it, you know, the steady job, more structure? You know.
Well, it's a combination of things. Something I hadn't done before. I mean, I had taught master classes and lectures and things, but not steadily like this. And it's a combination of things. But on one hand, I guess maybe something to do with age or experience or something, but a wish to connect with the younger generation. And I'm so pleased and so happy with the students. You know, the students that I've met through the composition lessons, really very inspiring for me, too. Hopefully for them as well. But it's really a wonderful experience. And it opens possibilities and doors and other things that were not part of my normal experience. Of course, the same way, I'm not doing some of the things I was doing before. There's so much time in life. But I had done it. I liked it. I was good at it. I could keep doing it. But that was kind of it. It wasn't changing much. And this is a new phase, and it's full of possibilities, and I'm enjoying it tremendously. And, yeah, it's fantastic the way it's going.
Oh, wonderful. And congratulations on, you know, where you are in your life and
finding yourself,
you know, in a place where you can be creative and travel up to frozen Winnipeg. We hope you make it back. I don't know if they have sled dogs that will go that far.
I hope so, too.
But it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Anytime.
No, thank you.
Let's keep the conversation going.
It's been a delight.
You've been listening to a conversation with Dr. Octavio Vasquez, teaches at Nazareth College, where he directs the composition program. This has been a special edition of Musicians of Rochester. I'm Brenda Trombley. Thank you for listening.